This week, KIRO gives transcribed voice to Anacortes, Washington. It would be easy to go overboard with enthusiasm about Anacortes. The town, hidden in the forest which skirts the sea, is like a never-never land with its air of peace and contentment and the compelling beauty of its natural setting.
Wow. The Skagit County town of Anacortes was once billed as the Venice of the Pacific, and if things had turned out a little differently, it might have become the economic capital of Washington. Historian Felix Bunnell is here, as he is every Wednesday, to tell us about a new exhibit and a new online archive about Anacortes newspaper history.
Yeah, you know, it's been 10 years since the PI folded its print edition, and the Seattle Weekly just did the same. But the Anacortes Museum has a new exhibit called Extra Extra, The Early Years of Anacortes Newspapers. It's in their jewel box of a museum in the old 1909 Carnegie Library in town. And the museum's also just debuted the first phase of a major project to put a huge newspaper archive online in cooperation with the Washington State Library. I spoke with Brett Lunsford the other day. He's the museum director. Pretty much every town of a certain size had its own newspaper back in the 1880s, so I asked him if there's anything special about Anacortes that warrants this new exhibit and archive.
I think so. I think that what's significant for Anacortes is that Amos Bowman, who's recognized as the town founder, was a journalist who had worked for the New York Tribune under Horace Greeley and took the Go West advice literally, and that was, he was only one of a couple of journalists who had city-building dreams along with his publishing interest.
So Amos Bowman, you know, he's the founder and namer of Anacortes. His wife was Anna Curtis. See what he did there?
Yes.
In the early 1880s, Bowman founded a paper called The Enterprise, and he also published a map to lure people to buy land and lure railroads to build Anacortes. So it's pretty cool the town was founded by a journalist who'd worked for that guy Horace Greeley, who famously told men, young men, to go west. And to hear Brent Lunsford tell it, in those early years in the 1880s, when there was just a handful of people in Anacortes, it seems that most of them were wayward journalists, all publishing or writing for local newspapers. Bowman's paper only lasted a few years, but one of the other papers, the Anacortes American, is still in business. It was founded in 1890 by two men, including an early settler named Douglas Almond, who made some keen observations about the young settlement.
He writes about visiting Anacortes in the 1880s and describes a bohemian group of reporters and printers there. He describes, at the time of the writer's first visit here, there was no wharf, passengers being put ashore in a rowboat and landed on the beach. This particular day, the only other passenger to land was a keg of beer, and it should be unnecessary to say the keg of beer was the most popular for the new arrivals.
You know, and many of the journalists were also real estate speculators, of course, and they were all pretty disappointed when the railroads didn't arrive, and the panic of 1893 didn't help matters much either, and only the Anacortes Americans survived the 1890s. And so what's now available online is the first three decades of the Anacortes American, from the very first issue of May 15, 1890, up to the end of 1922, and we have a link at My Northwest. And the Anacortes Museum is doing this in partnership with the Washington State Library, which is an arm of the Secretary of State's office. Other cities around Washington are also doing this, including the Eatonville Dispatch and the Cashmere Valley Record. I spoke with Sean Schollmeyer. She coordinates the newspaper archive for the Washington State Library. She says that along with a museum or a historical society, the publisher of a local paper, especially when the paper is still in business, can really make a difference in these preservation efforts.
The Anacortes American publishing staff has a really great tie to their past, and that is not necessarily constant in other areas. But the communities really rely on their publishers to show the local high school news, to show what events are coming up. And so communities like Eatonville and Anacortes, Cashmere, they're really very proud of their publishers and their publishing history. Their local newspaper means a lot to them.
Yeah, so this really wouldn't happen without the community's involvement. It's not like there's a big pot of money. There's a little bit of federal money to help run the state program, but the communities themselves and the newspapers and the organizations. And one of the other Anacortes papers featured in the exhibit is from Anacortes High School. Among that paper's many claims to fame is that the newspaper staff on the high school kids led the effort back in 1925 to adopt Seahawks as the school mascot. This was 50 years before our NFL team chose that name. And Brett Lunsford says the choice went far beyond just running a contest.
They actually put out a list of a number of different choices, including rum runners and crabs and a lot of just jokes. And the student body voted for Seahawk, which had been recommended by the staff.
Look at that.
So it's this long tradition of people on all levels of newspapers in Anacortes not being satisfied just reporting the news. They're actually sort of tinkering with the community, too, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful place still. And Grumis Island and the Olympics are a lot bigger than they seem from here when you're in Anacortes.
Mount Baker pops up like it's right in the backyard there. And there's a talk at the museum tonight at 7 o'clock, and the exhibit's open now. And the goal is to get all the newspaper up through the year 2000 online over the next few years.
Felix Bonnell's features are available anytime at MyNorthwest.com, and he joins us here every Wednesday. Thank you, Felix.
Thank you.
647, Seattle's Morning News. Courthouse facility dogs are a growing trend around the world. King County had the first courthouse facility dog, and a handful of others in the state now do as well. But some state lawmakers say that all courthouses could benefit from them, and so they're trying to lay out guidelines to make that happen. And Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott has more on that story. Hi, Hannah.
Hi, good morning. This bill comes from Democratic Senator Monka Dingra, not the most controversial of legislation. But Monka Dingra, of course, is a longtime prosecutor in the King County Courthouse, where they did have the first courthouse dog, Ellie, who passed away a few years ago, but not before making her mark. In fact, now they have a child center over at the King County Courthouse is called Ellie's Place in Ellie's name. We've talked about that before, where they do forensic interviews with kids of abuse that have to testify and things like that. So the idea here is to try to expand on that and really set these guidelines. Ellen O'Neill Stevens is with Courthouse Dogs Foundation. She trains some of these dogs and works in King County quite often. She says these are the kinds of situations that they're trying to avoid where the dogs could help. A story of a child sexual assault victim who had to testify against her abuser years later when she was 21 years old and there was no courthouse dog for her.
And when she found out that the defendant was representing himself and that he was going to be able to approach her where she was sitting on the witness stand, she left the courtroom, went to the rooftop 12 stories high of the King County Courthouse. She was up there for 3 hours while the police tried to talk her down. And when they finally succeeded in doing so, she told the prosecuting attorney that she couldn't proceed with this trial. That count was dismissed.
And a variety of people who testified about this had similar stories in courthouses all across our state, where the emotional trauma, it just becomes too much, and you lose a case like that. You lose a charge like that. So that's what they say these facility dogs can help with, among a variety of other things. There was another situation she described where there was a dog available. That was Ellie, of course, in King County, to help a developmentally disabled man who had been scammed by a woman, and he was simply too terrified to testify. But Ellie was there.
And by the time he went to the King County Courthouse to prepare for that trial, he was petrified. Fortunately, we had Ellie there, and she was the first in the United States, in the world. And when he met Ellie, it all changed for him. He felt safe around her. He explained, as a child would, about how this made such a difference to him. And he felt safe around her. He felt secure.
And so is the dog in the witness box?
Here's what happened. Yeah, so that in that case, the dog was allowed to go, and they are very specially trained. It's actually very cool. She talks about later that these dogs are bred from over 40 years. They've been breeding them now, and they're trained from birth with things like when they're nursing. They play fire engine sounds, police siren sounds, and things like that, and give them
nothing spooks them.
Nothing spooks them. Yeah. So they're very calm and at ease. Later on, she talked about her specifically doing some training where she took some of her puppies to hockey games where there's anger and there's excitement, and then you give them treats, right? So they're very calm, and they can be in these situations in a courtroom where if there is some tension or some aggression going on, they can just be there and be calm and help keep that witness calm. And all of these people who have been through this, she said that gentleman, the developmentally disabled man, was able to go through with that and testify and get through that case because of Ellie. That led, though, to a Supreme Court case because there was concern about whether having that dog in the witness box would taint a jury. Would prejudice the jury. So now at this point, they've came through that Supreme Court case and they've got these guidelines to deal with that. So what this bill would do would make it that any witness under 18 years of age would be able to have one of these dogs. A witness who is developmentally disabled would also be able to. And then any other witnesses may be allowed to use the courthouse facility dog if they have one available, if they meet certain conditions that are in line with that Supreme Court decision. You basically have to approve that there's a need and that it outweighs the risk of possibly tainting any jury. And then the goal is, though, to try to do it as much as possible without having the jury in the room, depending on if it's a jury trial or not.
So then is the presence of the dog then up to the judge?
When we get to that jury situation, if it's not a child or a developmentally disabled person, it's a must be able to have them if it's a child or a developmentally disabled person.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think that's that's great because I guess it's hard for people who haven't been through it to understand how vivid the memories can be when you're asked to testify. And that's the whole purpose, of course, of being bringing someone in to testify in person. You have to get at the truth. But,
and that's exactly what they said in here. You have painful. To get at the truth, but it's hard to get there. And this can help get to the truth. And depending on what kind of case we're talking about, you know, if it's a criminal case, a sexual abuse case involving a child, getting that truth is important. And getting that charge and that conviction is important. And sometimes these dogs can help get that there. These dogs are used also over at King County Courthouse, as I said, for those forensic interviews that you do with child sexual assault victims that make them comfortable in that in that facility there before you're even in the witness stand to share their story, put those allegations out there, and those are then used to file the charges. But it takes a bit to get the child comfortable enough to talk. So they're very important, and they hope here is with this bill to make sure everyone knows that we have these guidelines. Everyone across the state can have these courthouse dogs and use them.
Car Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
This is Seattle's Morning News, and let me introduce you now to presidential candidate Andrew Yang, who has made an incredible splash across the internet, sort of below the radar of broadcast media, but that's changing as well. And you have promoted a platform including a universal basic income, so I have to ask you, are you a billionaire or are you a multimillionaire? What are you?
You know, I've done all right, but I'm certainly nowhere near being a centimillionaire, billionaire. I mean, I ran a private company that did well, and so I feel like I'm quite fortunate in the scheme of certainly being the son of immigrants to this country. But I'm nowhere near the wealth and resources that many other political candidates might have.
Tell me about this concept of human-centered capitalism. What do you mean by that?
Well, we have to take a look around with clear eyes what's going on in our economy, where we're in this winner-take-all economy and the rewards are getting accrued to a smaller and smaller number of people at the top. And that's going to accelerate even more so with new technology. And you're in Seattle, you all see it around you increasingly. So we need to shift our economic thinking and our measurements to try and maximize human well-being. Because if we compete on capital efficiency, we're going to lose to the machines more and more.
So is that why you have proposed what you're calling this freedom dividend, a universal basic income of $1,000 per month for each American over 18?
Yes.
No strings attached.
Yeah.
It would replace, I assume, all welfare programs?
No, I'm a Democrat and progressive, and the last thing I would want to do is take away programs that people rely upon for their needs every day. And so my plan would be opt-in, where if you opt-in, then you would be foregoing benefits from various programs, but we would leave no one worse off. So if someone preferred their current benefits, then they would just stay on that program.
At $1,000 a month, we're talking about, well, roughly, what, $300 billion a month, right?
Again, we have to look around at what's going on in the economy, where Amazon, which is based in Seattle, paid zero in federal taxes last year, and Amazon's going to be one of the big winners from AI and the new economy. So what we have to do is we have to put the American people in position to benefit from all of this innovation. And the way I'd suggest doing that is by joining every other advanced economy and have a value-added tax. But keep in mind, you could easily tailor the value-added tax so it falls more heavily on luxury goods. And we'd also save billions of dollars on incarceration and homelessness services and emergency room health care. And by making our population stronger and healthier, it would increase our GDP by $700 billion just based upon higher graduation rates and better health outcomes and better mental health.
I feel like I'm going on a walk with you now.
Yes, that's what happens when you're running for president. You sort of start out in one place and then you wind up running someplace else. I apologize for the background.
No, that's no problem. That actually gives us an inside look at the reality of being booked basically 24/7. So describe for me how you've run this this internet campaign. I mean, you've apparently done quite a bit of successful fundraising here.
Yes, well, we've raised over $1 million since mid-February in our position to make the Democratic primary debates in June and July. So anyone listening to this thinking, like, hey, when am I going to see this guy again? At a minimum, you're going to see me at the DNC debates. But our campaign has caught fire because so many people in America know what we're experiencing. We know that 57% of us can't afford an unexpected $500 bill, and 78% are living paycheck to paycheck. And most of the new jobs getting created are gig and temporary and contractor jobs. And so I'm calling out the reality, the fact that it is not immigrants that are causing economic dislocations. It's the fact that we automated away 4 million manufacturing jobs, and we're in the process of doing the same thing to millions of retail jobs, call center jobs, fast food jobs, and on and on.
But you have to do more to address that than just universal basic income, don't you? Because I think people want to work. People want something to do with their time. They want to feel productive. In my day, I'm a boomer, you could get an assembly line job, right, if you didn't have any skills. There are always going to be people who don't have skills, and nobody seems to be trying to design jobs for them.
Well, I'm trying to do that. By putting money into people's hands, we're going to create all new forms of work that we actually want to do and care about. And I use my wife as an example. My wife's at home with our two boys, one of whom is autistic, and right now her work is valued at zero. So we have to broaden our definitions of work. Thomas Paine was for this at the founding of the country. He called it the citizen's dividend. Martin Luther King championed it in 1967 before he was killed. He called it the guaranteed minimum income. And Alaska is a deep red conservative state, and they love their oil check. And so what I'm saying is this is going to be the tech check, because it's going to put us in position to gain from all of the incredible innovation that's coming online.
Now, one of the things that has drawn some criticism about your campaign is that you have apparently a significant number of white nationalist supporters. Where did they get this idea that you are uniquely concerned with halting the decline of the white race, to quote from the Washington Post article about you?
Well, I've made a number of statements about the fact that 8 Americans are dying of opiates every hour, which is horrific. And I talk a lot about truck drivers, and I believe that most truck drivers are based in the Midwest, which has a certain racial makeup. And so I think that they looked at some of these statements and said, hey, Andrew Yang cares. And I do care, but I certainly don't court or cater to people with hateful ideologies.
So your strategy in the debates, how are you? Ultimately, you would have to, if you, of course, survive the nomination process, you'd have to handle Donald Trump. So how would you handle Donald Trump?
Well, I'm the opposite of Donald Trump. I am the Asian man who likes numbers. And I'm talking about the same problems he was talking about. It's just I have genuine solutions to offer. His solutions were build a wall, turn back time, bring back the jobs. I'm saying we have to turn the clock forwards. We have to start owning the reality of the 21st century. As a result, I'm already receiving support from many people who voted for Donald Trump because they see me as trying to solve the problems that he identified.
And you also seem to be getting support from that hard-to-capture group, the millennials. What do they like about you?
They're looking up at the reality that they face, whether they have a mountain of school loans and an uncertain job market and a warming climate. And the worst part is that many people blame them for some of this stuff. It's like, it's your fault, you're in debt, which really makes no sense. And again, the underemployment rate for recent grads has also crept up during this time. So I'm going to forgive a lot of that mountain of school loans, because young people should be starting their careers, starting families, buying homes, starting businesses, not paying off phantom loans for years on end.
Country's already got $22 trillion in debt. You can afford to forgive all those loans?
Yeah, you can. That's the wild thing. And the problem that you just articulated, which is held by various people, is that somehow America doesn't have the money. No one asked where the money was when we printed $4 trillion to bail out Wall Street.
So you just forgive the loans by printing the money?
Well, the great thing is, again, you have to look at, like, who's holding the loans right now? It's a bunch of financial institutions, you know, and then you have young people trapped in their parents' basement for what? This is a much more effective stimulus to the economy than printing money for the banks ever was.
And I'm curious, where have you been driving yourself to while we've been talking here?
I'm taking a car through Manhattan where my headquarters is. There's some traffic in Manhattan, so you can try and get work done.
That's a pretty impressive demonstration of multitasking, to be able to conduct a coherent interview while driving through Manhattan.
Well, I'm not physically behind the wheel, but thank you for the sentiment.
Andrew Yang, candidate for president. Mr. Yang, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And the full interview with Andrew Yang, including his transition from the office, down the elevator, out the door, and into the car, is on my Ross Files podcast, which has just gone up at mynorthwest.com.
Your daily dose of kindness. Now, it's actually an update to a story I shared with you last August in Minnesota.
where hockey reigns supreme, so too does the flow. Flow is slang for hockey hair. I guess we should learn that now since we have a team coming. Yeah, it grows long. That's what you do when you play hockey. But one high school team gave up their flow for one of their own, student team manager Cade Anderson. He was about to undergo a bone marrow transplant for his second round with cancer, and because of the treatments, he was losing his hair, his flow. So his team, in a show of support, told Care 11 News they would shave off their hair.
All the hair that we cut on last night, beginning of the night, there was only like 3-4 of us. They're going to cut our hair and then convince the next guy, then the next guy.
Cade had no idea he was getting ready for his procedure, and then pictures started showing up on his phone.
It shows that they're willing to do pretty much anything just to help me get through this.
So, the update. As Cade underwent his treatment for a rare form of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, his team played on, and for the first time in their school's history, became the Class A state hockey champions.
It's tough to find words to explain.
It almost just seemed like we gelled together better and everyone was together.
But their athletic coach knew exactly what it was.
We're champions because that kid, Cade, is a champion.
He's pointing to Cade, by the way, who is now cancer-free.
Excellent. I was hoping for a happy ending.
You going to grow some flow for the new NHL team in Seattle?
I'm not capable of growing flow at this stage, Colleen.
I think you could.
I can grow it everywhere except right there. You see that part there?
Okay.
And no flow there.
Well, I think we can have some advice on how to
That's all right.
style. Maybe look to the president.
Number one.
Thanks a lot.
Number one, don't shave the beard anymore. You can have a playoff beard year round.
That's true. So if you can't have the flow, you can't have the beard.
I'll think about
Consider
that.
Consider it.
Here he is, trying as hard as he can to grow his flow, Danny O'Neill. Wow.
That's a hockey term.
It is a hockey term. We're trying to learn.
Yeah. His flow. His mm-hmm. cabbage.
That's right.
Oh, his cabbage.
That's also referred
like
to
that.
Some lettuce if it dangles a little too far out the back.
Watch the kale, though. I hear there's pesticides in it. Anyway, here's Domingo Santana's first hit as a Mariner.
Fires, deals, fastball, swung on, hit to right field and deep. It's a slicing drive. Giddy up, gone! Grand slam! Domingo Santana!
Jeez. Grand slam. Now, there is no more auspicious start than that, is there?
No, it's pretty good. 9-7 victory in Tokyo.
Yeah.
Tim Beckham also with the 2-run homer, and Tim Beckham had a bat flip. You familiar with the
I
bat flip?
I did see you just going back and forth with somebody on Twitter about this bat flip. People don't like bat flips?
Some people think it's a little too emotional and you're trying to show up the pitcher. I say show a little emotion.
Yeah.
You club the ball 400 feet, yeah.
So we want
to flip the bat.
We want football players to break each other's bones, but we don't want baseball players to flip bats?
That's correct. There are some old school, they generally tend to be codgers, maybe bordering on coots. Have you ever realized that? There's a codger.
It's sort of a...
Codger's kind of
different
lovable.
Stages. Yeah.
Correct. The coot. The coot is someone who's just mean.
Come
He's
on.
Just mean, man. People who don't like bat flips, coots.
Yeah.
Crazy old coots that
Probably
are there.
Probably they've never had a chance to flip their own bat.
Yeah, that's right.
Are
never done anything
that?
Worth bat flipping over.
There How many bat go. Flips do you get? Do you get two? Do you get three before you get tossed? What is it?
No, you don't ever get tossed over a bat flip.
Okay.
You end up taking a fastball in the ear over a bat flip.
I see.
And so that's the thing, is it depends on who's throwing the pitch.
Oh, so pitchers even don't like that showmanship.
That's generally who it is.
What is going
pitchers
on?
Pitchers are grumps.
Baseball needs some more showmanship.
I would agree.
Thank you.
Yeah. Heck yeah, it does.
Yeah.
We need to go talk to some of these old school pitchers who are like, show me up, you're going to wear one in your ear the next time around.
Yeah.
Rick Riz noticed that in Japan, they not only have a ceremonial first pitch, they have a ceremonial first batter.
Yeah, which is awesome.
What? So how does that, the ceremonial first pitcher pitch the ceremonial batter? Is that how it works?
Yes. And I hope that the ceremonial batter gets to take a big rip at it.
Yeah.
And I think that's something we should institute here in America.
For sure.
When Dave Ross throws out the opening pitch.
No,
he's got to go for batter now. He's already on the pitch. Now you got to be the ceremonial first batter.
No. He's going to throw the pitch again because I'm going to be the batter.
Yeah. Oh, I see.
And
if you're
the batter, then I'm...
I'm going to wait to bat flip. I'm going to bat flip into oblivion after I ground out to shortstop.
So wait, is the point...
I hope you plan to hit the ball straight up, because that's about the trajectory of Dave's ball coming down. You have to really get up on
top
of it.
Well, that's what makes it so difficult to hit, Chris.
Well, with the ceremonial first pitch and batter, is the goal to strike him out or to let him hit?
I don't know.
I'd be very confused.
I would say this. It's got to be to throw it past him, right? You're not getting up there to get hit.
So it's a competition even in the ceremony?
Should be.
Okay.
It's baseball, right?
All right.
Yeah, yeah. This is you're either competing or you're not.
Yeah.
It's like Pete Carroll's rules. If I've bat flipped on you, would you throw one at my ear the next time up?
I would try.
Would you?
I'm not sure.
You'd be a headhunter?
Still working on my placement.
You'd be fussy?
You might get Dave's first bird.
He'd turn into a coot. Yeah. All of a sudden, Dave would be up there, and you'd see him. He'd look like a long leer at me.
I'm just a curmudgeon.
Yeah, curmudgeon.
I'm not to the coot stage yet.
Mariners are 1-0.
1-0, and I don't know. I don't want to get hopeful too soon. I'm curious how Colleen is feeling when you start the season with a grand slam, a 9-7 victory.
Always optimistic.
She's all
always.
In.
I'm still she's with all in. Been there since 95.
Heck yeah.
Ride or die, true to the blue. Let's do this.
Yeah, let's go. 162-0. We're on pace to be undefeated.
Yeah.
Domingo Santana is going to hit 162 home runs and drive in 648. Runs, is my math right? It's always dangerous to do math on the radio.
See, I would believe you. I have no idea.
I believe it's 648. If he plays in all 162 games and hits a grand slam in every one and does nothing else, he'll drive in 648
that would be like
runs.
A bowler who gets all strikes.
Yeah, that happens.
For the whole tour.
Perfect game. Yeah, sure. Why not?
One more thing. There was a story about Earl Thomas finally explaining his middle finger.
He was flipping off Pete Carroll.
He was flipping off Pete Carroll.
Yeah. I always wondered if Earl Thomas had gotten an extension, and he'd gotten hurt in the fourth game of the season, and Pete Carroll flipped him off as he left the field on the cart. How would everybody have felt about that?
Yeah,
it would have been pretty mad.
I hadn't thought about that.
It would have been really unclassy. But instead, we're just like, hey, it's just Earl. He saw the coach, and he was mad, so he flipped him off. Isn't that what you always do to your boss? Like, him, and you're mad at him, and all of a sudden, you've never flipped any.
That's what I'm saying.
He's never flipped anybody off.
I didn't flip
you're anybody. A terrible, terrible test
I didn't
question.
Flip drivers off.
Yeah. I've encouraged you to flip me off. Maybe if I bat flipped, you'd flip me off.
I don't even flip houses.
What about pancakes, Dave? Do you flip pancakes?
Well, I tried once.
Do you wear flip-flops?
No, no, not anymore because they irritate my toes.
He calls them just John Kerry's.
Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And what is it time
for now? I think we talked sports, right?
Huh? What?
Did we just talk sports?
I never really know. Tax talk. Less than a month for the filing deadline, and we're still hearing stories about people who are shocked about not getting a refund. So I called up our tax whisperer, Don DeSantis from Clifton Larson Allen, to explain that just because you don't get a refund, it does not mean you did not get a tax cut.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, if you're looking at it from sort of good economic theory, you know, one of the things about a tax cut is, you know, it's meant to stimulate the economy. You don't want to wait till April of 2019 when people file their tax returns to give them big refunds. You want to get the money out into their hands as soon as possible. And so the IRS adjusted all the withholding tables for 2018.
Right. So people already got their money, but they were expecting that big bump at the end of the year. And so they're still upset. So what do you tell them?
Well, you know, the people are complaining because, you know, the fact is they might have gotten $50 more in their paycheck every month or every paycheck. Let's say they're paid a couple of times a month. Somehow that $50 gets forgotten compared to a $1,200 refund at the end of the year. I mean, it's the same amount of money, but it's much easier to see the $1,200 than the $50 they got in every paycheck.
So what you need to do is, rather than look at the amount of your refund, is to look at that line which says amount of tax owed. And is it fair to say that if your income this year was the same as your income last year, everything else being equal, the amount of tax paid should be less?
It definitely should. We're still surprisingly kind of early, at least as far as statistics for the 2018 tax filing season. But it's estimated that about 80% of individuals will get some sort of tax reduction. But, you know, if you got a $1,000 refund check last year and this year you got a $500 refund check, it suddenly seems like something's wrong. Your taxes have gone up. But in reality, you might have had more in your pocket all throughout the year.
Now, some other things that people, I think, might have been surprised by was finding out that for those who itemized deductions for charity didn't go as far as usual because you have a cap on the amount of property tax you can deduct, and you have a very large standard deduction, which means that you had to give quite a bit to charity to get any extra benefit from it.
Yeah, that for individuals, that's one of the really significant changes, that $10,000 cap affects any state that has high taxes. So if you live in a state like New York or California or Massachusetts, you're really feeling the pain. Now, we don't have a state income tax here, but we still have fairly high property taxes and sales taxes. So let's take a scenario where you've paid your house off. You don't owe anything on your house.
Right.
you know, you're going to have $10,000 in taxes no matter what your taxes are. I mean, your taxes can be $20,000.
That's your maximum deduction, yeah.
All you're going to get is 10. Well, the standard deduction is around $24,000, $24,500. So unless you're giving $14,000 or more to charity, you know, you're not going to itemize. You're just going to take the standard deduction. So what I'm saying to people is, when you know, look at your tax return, look on page 2 and see what the final tax number is. Okay, don't focus so much on your refund or whether you owe money or you're going to get a refund. You know, look at what your tax is and compare that to 2017. That's going to tell you whether your taxes went down or not.
Right. By the way, I notice I'm getting a lot more tax forms, last-minute tax forms from companies. Are the rules still being changed or what?
Well, what happens in every tax law is that there's lack of clarity sometimes. And it's like, well, what does this really mean? How do I interpret this? And particularly in the area for self-employed people, what got a lot of publicity is this special 20% deduction against their income if you were self-employed. And, you know, on the surface, it seemed really straightforward. But once you dive into it, it's incredibly complex. And the IRS has been putting up proposed regulations and more regulations and more regulations. Even the software companies, up until a week ago, they were still saying, oh, by the way, our programming is behind because the IRS keeps changing things. Here's 9 things you have to do where you have to go in and override the software.
Well, now, if you're using a consumer tax package like TurboTax or TaxCut or something else, can you trust the result at this stage or do you have to wait another month?
I hope so.
Thanks for the reassuring answer, Don.
Yeah, I mean, because you know, the software we use is one of the premier packages in America. It's been around for 50 years or more. And so, if they're telling us here override these 9 things, I've got to wonder about the package that costs $49.95.
Well, that's going to make for an exciting month for you, isn't it?
Oh, definitely.
Our tax whisperer, Don DeSantis from Clifton, Larson, Allen. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien, and here's Rachel Bell with another story about how a municipal government is attempting to make its citizenry healthier.
Yes. In New York City, the mayor, Bill de Blasio, which I always want to say it like Bill de Blasio, but that's besides the point. He has introduced Meatless Mondays. So for the 2019-2020 school year, all the kids going to public school in New York City are going to have Meatless Monday lunch. That means, oh, and breakfast too. All vegetarian breakfast and lunch offerings. This was something that they did in a pilot program last year. The idea is, as you can imagine, for health, but mostly what they're talking about is for reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
Now, how do Meatless Mondays reduce greenhouse gas emissions?
You know, in theory, if we are raising fewer animals for meat, that would be less.
All right.
You know, great. But this doesn't necessarily mean that production is going to slow down. And that's the problem in all these cases. I heard something on a podcast the other day because I myself try to be as green as I can. And I'm going to be bringing a couple stories this week about places in the city you can go to fill up bottles with laundry detergent, you know, so you don't have to keep buying plastic.
Right, sure.
But on a podcast I was listening to, they said, you know, all of that is just a distraction. If you and I, you know, start doing that method, how big of a dent is it going to make? The corporations need to make changes. The government needs to make changes. We're kind of being fooled into thinking that we're making big changes. But then, you know, you look at Trader Joe's and they answered the calls of, you know, people who are writing in and saying, we don't like all the plastic you use. And that was a big change that was made by a company influenced by what consumers said.
Well, you have to start small. And,
yes.
And corporations have, I think they've become more and more responsive to what customers want, whether it's to save the planet or, you know, to stock more Twinkies. If you start doing it on an individual basis, I think they usually follow.
Yeah, and, you know, it's just New York City, but I'm sure there's a lot of schools there, and the people that they buy the meat from are not going to be getting that purchase. So let's say, you know, every big metropolitan city in America did this, there would be less meat being purchased, and maybe that would influence the system. But, of course, there are plenty of parents who are complaining and saying, we don't want you, you know, regulating what our children eat. How dare you make them go vegetarian?
Right.
I think that's silly. You know, they can eat meat for dinner that night at home. It's one day a week. And the biggest thing of all, they can still bring their own lunch. This is only eating in the school cafeteria.
So this governs what the schools are offering the kids as a cafeteria meal.
Mm-hmm.
But they can still bring their own
hamburgers to school if they want to.
Yes, and hot dogs.
Well, good. Then freedom hasn't died yet in
That's
America.
Right. I mean, you could say that this is going to affect the poor students who have to eat at school because they're on the lunch program. But again, I don't think that not eating meat once a week is going to do any harm.
Well, I mean, but and if it means the poor students are healthier than the rich students, that's not a bad outcome, is it?
Well, that's what I'm curious. I haven't been able to read exactly what the menu is going to be because being vegetarian does not necessarily mean that you are healthy. I have had a few friends and lovers in my life over the years who have been vegetarians, and that has meant that they eat a lot of noodles and a lot of cheese and a lot of bread, not very many vegetables. So, you know, you could have a cheese pizza every day and be a vegetarian, but that doesn't necessarily mean you're eating super healthy.
Well, a lot of times it depends on why you've decided to get into the vegetarian game. Are you doing it to save the earth or doing it to save yourself? I figured that there must be a reason that the human race has managed to survive for millions of years before we started trying to civilize ourselves. And that means there must be something programmed in you which attracts you to certain kinds of foods. And if you listen to that little voice, shouldn't that be enough?
Ooh, if I listened to my little voice, I'd be on a steady diet of grilled cheese sandwiches and Kraft mac and cheese.
Maybe you should try that.
Maybe I should. I did eat. I used to write for The Stranger here in Seattle, and I ate, 10 boxes of mac and cheese in one night, not the full box, to do a story, a comparison. I will tell you, it is not good. Does not do the body good. I had the yellow number 5 sweats for the rest of the night. Yeah, that's something I've actually always wondered, is why do we crave things that are bad for us? What is that about human biology that we want to eat? Fatty, salty, sweet, cigarettes, drugs, like what is it?
Commercials during cartoon shows.
That's right. I do watch too many cartoons.
By the way, it won't shock you to know that the New York Post has come out against this whole Meatless Monday idea. In fact, they say, this is in a New York Post editorial, cutting out meat does more harm than good. Quoting a 2005 study by a University of California nutrition scholar who found that among school-aged children, those who consumed meat daily dramatically bested their vegetarian peers on muscle growth, problem-solving skills, and intelligence.
Well, how about that? I don't think one meal a week is going to cut down on test scores.
I don't know. We don't have any more parents having to bribe soccer coaches because their kids grew up with a vegetarian diet.
I hope that there's going to be some kind of new system at school, like instead of drug dealers, there's going to be meat dealers, and you can meet behind the lockers or under the bleachers and get yourself like a black market hot dog during lunch.
Black market in New York City.
Yeah.
Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you, Dave.